Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's called Heartbleed. That's got to be bad, right? What we know and what to do about the latest online data problem we all seem to have. Kind of gets tough to keep them straight, doesn't it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, gang, the 9th of April. Great to have you with us. And depending on your innate level of cynicism, it may or it may not come as a surprise to you that everything you thought was secure on the internet may very well not be. There is, we have been discovering the past day or two, a really serious glitch in a certain type of security software called OpenSSL, the computer code behind that little locked symbol you see on what you think are secure sites. It has been called, this glitch has, by one computer guy not known for hyperbole, an 11 on a scale of 1 to 10. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. He is here in L.A. this week, and he is here right now to explain. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai.
Let us start, I suppose, with the basics. This thing called OpenSSL, which is the vulnerability here. What is it?
So this is a protocol. It's not like a service like Twitter or something like that. It's a tool. So it's like email. It's very basic. It stands for Open Secure Sockets Layer. It's a way that we transfer and protect sensitive data online. So when you log into your bank, when you log into, I don't know, anything that you might log into, you're probably using some form of SSL. And that's sort of the problem. I talked to a cybersecurity researcher, Brian Krebs, this week. He basically said, stay off the internet.
No, did he really?
And, you know,
like, seriously, stay off?
Yes. He basically said, stay off the internet. Now, I mean, he laughed when he said it, but that gives you the sense of the scope of this thing.
And it's something inside. It's some line of code inside this thing that's been compromised, right? Just to be clear?
Yes. Okay. It's basically a security hole in the code. The code is hundreds of thousands of lines long, so it's kind of complicated.
Well, let me ask you then why this code is hundreds of thousands of lines long. It's this thing called open source software, right? Which means anybody can climb in there and build on it, right?
Right. So like so many things in the tech world, this was started as a sort of open source project by this guy, Eric Young, in the 1990s. Eric Young was hired by the security firm RSA and moved on to other things. But as it happens often in the tech world, this thing that he had built was picked up by other coders, other people who said, hey, this thing is cool. Let's keep working on this. And they kept bolting on extra little bits of code, extra little bits of functionality. And that's how we are where we are.
All right. If I am a company and now am panic stricken because I've seen all this stuff in the past 2 days, what am I doing?
It depends on how big you are. So if you're a startup, this might not be a huge impact. You might not have a ton of users who you need to sort of ask them to change their passwords, build a patch for this. If you're Yahoo, you got a big problem. And it could cost a lot of money. It could cost a lot of resources to build a security patch to fix the problem. Canada's version of the IRS shut down part of their websites today.
Really?
Just
if so, only that would happen here. It's almost tax time.
I know.
Sorry,
it's the worst timing, but
we should say that fixes are in the works. And also, there are a couple of sites out there, and we'll have the links on our website. There are sites out there where you can go to check to see if Heartbleed is affecting your thing, right?
Yep, that's absolutely right. There are sites where you can check. And a lot of coders have not had a lot of sleep over the past 48 hours.
Should I be changing my password right now?
No. Oh. You should wait. First of all, don't go to your bank's website. Don't try and log in. Don't try and change your password. Wait until the bank tells you that you can change your password. That's the advice I've been getting from cybersecurity experts. You should wait for the company to get in touch with you to change your stuff.
We will have a link, as I said, to that place where you can check on this Heartbleed.
Dramatic enough of a name, Heartbleed.
I know, right? Ben Johnson, he hosts Marketplace Tech. Ben, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
The drama today on Wall Street, by the way, was all on the upside. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. According to the Wall Street Journal this morning, Goldman Sachs is thinking about making a change. To be just a bit more specific, executives at Goldman are toying with the idea of shutting down their dark pool. That's a private stock market, if you will, where traders trade anonymously and usually at lower cost as well. Lots of big banks have them. It's not just Goldman. And they've been getting a lot of attention the past week or so since that new Michael Lewis book came out that we had on last Tuesday, I suppose. Why, though, would Goldman shut down their dark pool now? Marketplace's Bree Benishore takes us into the choppy waters of those dark pools.
Think of a dark pool as an actual swimming pool for a second. It's Goldman Sachs' private swimming pool for stock trading, as opposed to, say, the public pool, which is the stock exchange. At the regular stock exchange, like the public pool, everyone can see you and stare. So, for example, let's say you wanted to buy some huge amount of shares. If you do that in broad daylight, people will see you with your big order, and they'll raise the price on you before you're even done. In a dark pool, you can trade in private.
Large institutional investors like this as a way of minimizing their price impact and reducing their trading costs.
That's Craig Perrong at the University of Houston. So one of the big draws for Goldman is privacy. It also doesn't charge as much for its pool. But
there's just a lot of suspicion.
The flip side of increased privacy is decreased transparency.
There's probably a considerable deal of regulatory uncertainty and legal uncertainty.
And customers may see a conflict of interest.
You know, it might be better if people weren't worried that I was only going to my dark pool because it was my dark pool.
Joe Goronsky is president of Rosenblatt Securities. So on top of the fact that who knows how legal this will all be in the future, it's a bit of a PR problem.
There are other methods to get price improvement and to hide your order other than using your own dark pool.
Like go to somebody else's dark pool. So it really is like swimming pools. Sometimes it's best to use your neighbor's. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Thanks to the Comcast-Time Warner merger hearing in the Senate today, we now know which senators are unhappy with their cable service and which of them want better high-speed internet connections. Those questions actually were asked, but more to the point, and thanks to a 180-page statement that Comcast filed with the FCC, we know Comcast thinks there is absolutely nothing for consumers to worry about with this deal. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has been asking around about that.
Andy Hargreaves is an analyst with Pacific Crest. He looks at both TV and tech. He found today's Senate hearing a little odd.
All these guys are talking about pay TV. All the questions were about that. This deal is not even about pay TV. It's about broadband and having control of high-quality broadband.
And Hargreaves says, no, Comcast does not need to get bigger to be a strong player in broadband. It's already dominant. He estimates the merged company would have the best quality service in about 70% of the U.S. market. He thinks that's a problem. It gives the company power to keep jacking up rates, which he calls a Comcast specialty. However, he doesn't think these questions are enough to sink the deal. Merging the companies, he says, doesn't actually make it much harder for a real competitor to emerge.
It's already near impossible, so raising the bar from really, 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 really high to really, 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 really high isn't that big of a deal.
David Balto is an antitrust lawyer and a former Federal Trade Commission official. He thinks the merger will likely be approved. Comcast and Time Warner aren't competing with each other before the merger in existing markets, so consumers aren't losing choices.
You may not like the competitive environment, but there are scores of mergers which the FTC and the Justice Department have approved because they could not find, you know, a loss of competition.
So how might real competition in broadband get fostered? So far, there's no good answer to that one. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
All right, quick. What do the following have in common? Corona beer, Vietnamese pho, and what? A nice refreshing gin and tonic. How about that? Limes is what they have in common. About which, some bad news. Supply is short, which means prices are high. From Austin, Texas, Joy Diaz has more.
So, how expensive are limes these days? Let's ask Danny Herrera, who manages one of the most expensive Mexican restaurants in Austin. A place called Fonda San Miguel. Herrera says 6 months ago, he was paying $14 a case.
And then they kind of went up to $20-something dollars, and then it slowly started getting higher and higher. And as of last week, it was at $99.
Herrera stopped garnishing his meals with limes, and he's rethinking his margarita prices. Most of the limes we consume come from Mexico, particularly the state of Michoacán. But that's an area dominated by the drug cartels and citizen militias. Producers say they'd rather burn their crops than sell at the pitiful prices the cartels pay. I talked to one of the lime producers in Michoacán. He asked me to change his name to Carlos because he's afraid of the cartels. Carlos says local lime prices are not high. They've held steady.
I don't get why the public thinks the price is too high.
When I told Carlos that some restaurateurs in the U.S. are paying around $100 per case, he was shocked.
Son of a, that's a gross exaggeration.
Carlos says somebody's making a lot of money, but it isn't him. He says floods and plagues have cut citrus production in Mexico by half. And there's a growing global taste for limes.
In Asia, it is an important part of its supply and demand.
Dr. Eric Thor from the Agribusiness School in Arizona State University says limes are more expensive, in part because there are millions more people using them now.
We today use the fruits and everything from special margaritas to Asian noodles.
Now, planes full of fruit from the Americas are flown to China, and that has increased the price of everything, from limes to cherries. But why are we here in the United States paying for what consumers in China want? Thor says basically because we're still willing to pay for limes no matter the price.
They will come down based upon the time of year.
And based upon production.
¿Qué tal? ¿Cómo están?
As for now, it's hard to find limes in some Austin taco eateries. During my last visit to my favorite taco place, the attendant handed me a lemon instead of a lime. Can you believe that? In my book, that's a no-no. Tacos and lemons don't go together. In Austin, I'm Joy Diaz for Marketplace.
Coming up, hey, nice to meet you. What do you do anyway?
The millennials, the Gen Xers, seem a little shy about this question, and they think it's a bit too nosy.
Oh. Small talk from coast to coast in our series, American Futures. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, shaping up to be a good day on Wall Street became a very good day indeed after investors got a hold of the minutes from the Fed's last meeting. The Dow Industrials up 181 points, 1.1%, closed at 16,437. The NASDAQ soared 70 points, almost 1.75%, finished at 4183. The S&P 500 up 20 points, about 1.1%, ended things at 1872. A lot of those gains came after the report from last month's Fed meeting were released and seemed to show no plans to tighten monetary policy, that is, raise interest rates anytime real soon. Told you about Comcast Time Warner Cable merger and the hearings they're into earlier. Comcast shares up almost 2% today. Time Warner Cable up 1.75%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.69%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanderbilt University Medical Center, the promise of discovery, using a patient's DNA to tailor transplant care at vanderbilthealth.com. By CSX, whose trains can move a ton of freight nearly 450 miles on 1 gallon of fuel. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by Kronos, offering cloud-based workforce management solutions to help organizations of all types and sizes achieve their strategic goals. More at Kronos.com. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. Have something to say about one of our stories or want to suggest your own? Find us on Twitter at MarketplaceAPM or join us on Facebook to interact with producers, reporters, and the hosts of Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, a look at the nation's balance sheet. The Treasury Department issues its monthly statement for March. Drone delivery is just one of the topics at the 4th Annual Postal Vision 2020 Conference, getting underway in the nation's capital. And think eloquent thoughts. April is National Poetry Month. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We told you yesterday about coal miners in eastern Kentucky and how they're trying to wrap their minds around a future without coal as the energy market changes. There might be some lessons for those folks from a small village in the north of England. For more than 100 years, Brampton in Yorkshire was home to the Cortonwood coal mine, Like all of the UK's deep mines at the time, it was state-owned. Until 30 years ago, almost to the day, when Cortonwood was told their mine and others were going to close. What followed was a bitter, year-long, and ultimately unsuccessful national coal strike. Marketplace's Stephen Beard went back to Brampton to find out how that village has been doing after coal.
I'm standing in the car park of a big, successful retail centre, but this was once a battleground, the cradle of one of the bitterest conflicts in the history of British labour unrest. 30 years ago, this was the site of Cortonwood Pit, or Colliery as it's known, where the national miners' strike erupted.
More shield units are moving up, police carrying six-foot plastic shields and wearing helmets, and the mounted police are going in again.
In coalfields across Britain, pickets and police fought pitched battles. The miners were fiercely resisting the closure of their industry as an attack on their community.
Coal was this community. It was that important.
Denise Fitzpatrick, wife of an ex-miner at Cortonwood Pit.
It was the community, not just here, but in all mining villages. Everything revolved around colliery.
1,200 men worked at Cortonwood, among them Mike Clark. Like his grandfather and his father, he went down the pit straight from school. Just turned 15, he scrambled nervously on board the miner's cage and began his first descent, more than 3,000 feet to the bottom of the shaft.
And it set off going, I thought, this not right, this.
You had a sinking feeling.
I certainly did. And it starts going down and down and down, and you think, will I see my mum again?
In spite of those early misgivings, Mike worked in the pit for 29 years, and when it was announced that his and many other pits were uneconomic and had to be closed, he enthusiastically joined the strike.
Why fight to keep an industry like that going? I mean, this, after all, was a difficult, dangerous and dirty job.
It were my job. That's what it were. It were my job. And that's the most thing when you're a working man. You've got pride, you've got your family, and you look after them the best you can, and that's the best way I could.
You'll be able to say to yourselves, with pride in your eyes...
Militant union leader Arthur Scargill egged on the miners who stayed out on strike for a year.
And in doing so, was able to be part and parcel of the greatest victory in trade union history.
But it wasn't a victory, it was a bitter defeat. The government closed Cortonwood and many other deep mines, and this once proud, well-paid village slid into poverty and deprivation. Denise Lelliott, an ex-miner's daughter, says when the pit closed, those who could find work usually made barely half what they earned underground. Many others languished on welfare.
It's ripped the soul out of this community. So I love my community, and it absolutely destroys me where it's done to it. And people says it recovered, and it hasn't. And I don't think it ever will.
Even today, nearly 30 years after the pit closed and after many of the pitmen have retired or died, the unemployment rate among the ex-miners of Cortonwood is still 12%. Andy Locke works for a charity which in recent years has tried to mitigate the effects of mass unemployment caused by the coal mine closures of the 1980s.
In my opinion, there's a lack of support at the time. So when you have over 100,000 people over a period of time becoming unemployed, with the kind of lack of infrastructure in these communities and the lack of support going into them, problems are going to happen.
Belatedly, the British government did pump money into places like Cortonwood. This retail park opened for business some 15 years after the pit closed. It has been a big success. It has brought prosperity to the village, and it is a significant employer. But not, says Denise Fitzpatrick, for the dwindling band of ex-miners, or colliers as they're known here.
They're into collier, I know, out of this or any other village, that would be content to go and stand at the back of a counter, because their life were down pit, working, labouring very hard down that pit.
To mark the 30th anniversary of the miners' strike, this musical show called Burning Issues has been touring the country's former goldfields.
Out of the dirt and darkness I was born, go down.
The show portrays the miners as heroic figures who went down fighting. Since Cortonwood closed, Mike Clark has thrived in the very different career of nursing. but he still misses the camaraderie of the pit, doesn't regret resisting the closure, and urges American miners to do the same, even though there is life after coal.
There is life after coal, yeah, because you've got to make life after coal. Just don't lay down and die. But go down fighting, go down kicking and screaming, make it as hard for them as you possibly can.
In Corton Wood, South Yorkshire, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Could listen to those accents all day, huh? We talked to former miners in Appalachia and Yorkshire about the mining life. We've got them on an audio slideshow at marketplace.org. We check in every now and then with Jim Fallows. He's the national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. We go out on the road with him and his wife Deb every so often as well for a series and a project that we call American Futures.
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Cirrus 435 Sierra Romeo, we've got Tango for landing.
The whole point of flying around the country in a small plane, as they do, is to get a picture of America and the American economy and the way people live in it. And on that note, today, a special guest, Deb Fallows. She is a linguist by training who's been looking at something we all do pretty much every day, but apparently that we all do very, very differently. Say hello.
In New York City, we always started conversations with strangers with, so what neighborhood do you live in?
In Chicago, you ask them, what parish you're from?
In Hawaii, we would ask, where did you go to school?
So, Deb, it's good to have you on.
Kai, great to hear you. Thanks.
I would ask where you're from or what you do, but that actually is what we're going to talk about here. It actually means something, the way these people answer this question, doesn't it?
It does. It's a question that matters. You know, it's something we say all the time, but it's really a loaded question because if you're saying it or if you're having to answer it, you know that somebody's kind of digging for information to put you into their world. How do you fit into my world?
And it varies depending on where people live, which I think is just the most fascinating part. And we've got a bunch of tape that we're going to play here as we get going. But I will go from my own experience, which is East Coast based. And you wrote about this in your blog post about this thing. A lot of people in Washington, D.C. and on the East Coast, after the hi, how are you, it's what do?
If you go to a party, it's where do you work and what is your job?
What do you do? Which is almost, are you anybody? Is there something you can do for me?
It is a very networky, probing, ranking kind of question.
It is. And that probably is the introductory question that I hate the most. And I'll have to tell you, it is alive and well in Washington, D.C. And I understand still alive and well in New York, too. But being someone from the Midwest, it's not a question I was used to.
This whole idea of what do you do, and I don't know, maybe it's just me, but it seems to be being asked not a whole lot by younger professionals, by younger people.
That's right. The millennials, the Gen Xers, seem a little shy about this question, and they think it's a bit too nosy. Hmm. And, you know, a lot of these kids in this generation are having a hard time finding their way and finding jobs, and so people don't ask it as much. And curiously, what do you do? If you ask that question in Burlington, Vermont, or Denver, Colorado, people will say, well, I ski, or I run a lot, or, you know, I have a little boat. So it's a very different question.
Which is to say they have a life that's not just work, right? Like some of us should really get a grip on.
Absolutely. We should all be in Burlington.
There was one from New Orleans that it literally made my head snap. Here you go.
When you're meeting somebody in New Orleans for the first time, you might say, hey, how's your mama and them?
How's your mama and them? Hello?
Isn't that the best? Yeah.
Unless it's, you know, I mean, when somebody asks me, how's your mama? I'm like, I don't think so, pal.
Well, when a reader wrote in to me about that, I wrote back and said, surely you're pulling my leg on this one. And they said, no, that's the New Orleans question. And that mama question gets to who are your people? And I guess in New Orleans, it's so tight that you would know by the last name exactly where you came from.
And who's your mama? all right, here's another one. Take a listen to this.
In New York City, we always started conversations with strangers with, so what neighborhood do you live in?
And it tells you a little bit as well, the answer to this question of where you live, it tells you about not just upbringing, but professional achievement level and socioeconomic status. I mean, all of that stuff.
It tells you all of that stuff, and it tells you cultural stuff. I mean, if I say to somebody in New York, where do you live? And they say Upper East Side, you know that's very different from if they say Brooklyn.
You bet. No, that's exactly true. That's exactly true. Or it's I live right by, you know, the 405 and the 10 or something, right? And you find a freeway and you throw that out. As opposed to a subway stop in Manhattan or a, you know, a T stop in Boston.
You know, now, the 405 and the 10, that brings me to a question that people said comes straight from L.A., which is, how'd you get here?
Yeah.
And then the follow-up was, where'd you park?
Yeah, that is also true. That is also true. Deborah Fallows, she is the better half of the project that we are doing with The Atlantic Magazine and her husband, Jim. It's called American Futures. There's more, obviously, on all the websites, ours and The Atlantic's. It's marketplace.org. Deb, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai. See you soon.
Also online, I should have said, is a map of our travels with Jim and Deb and a video that Deb and The Atlantic made about saying hello. It's pretty cool. Check it out at marketplace.org, he says again. And tell us where we ought to go next. You can tweet us at MarketplaceAPN.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This final note on the way out, in which I will exercise the host's prerogative and declare this week's sign, the apocalypse is upon us. I've been away, which is maybe how I missed this, but you know Peeps, those marshmallow bird-like things that you get around Easter? Just Born, the company that makes them, says that starting on May the 1st, they will be available all year round. We are making every day into a holiday, a company official was quoted as saying. No, sir. No, you are not. Call me. Go ahead. Call me a curmudgeon. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 181 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ, 70 points. Get that, almost 1.75%. The S&P 500 up 20 points, 1.1% there as well. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.